author and Northwestern professor, Laura Kipnis, Chicago Children's Theater's Frank Maugrey, and the Swap Meet with Greg Clam. And now, here's your host, a man who, like Mike Glennon, says this is his year, Justin Kaufman.
I like Stephanie being like, you can just hear it in her voice. Mike Glennon? This is my year. This is my year. How many times did he say that yesterday? This is my year. It was almost like a mantra. He's like the Stuart Smalley of football. I'm good enough. I'm strong enough. And gosh darn it, this is my year. Oh, man. And you know it's his year until he throws two interceptions against Detroit in week three. This is your half a year, bud. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Very excited to be with you. We got a great show lined up midway through the week. It's exciting around here right now. Walk of Fame. Everyone's getting all jacked up and ready for the big ceremonies tomorrow morning. We got a show tonight. We'll keep motoring along. Mike Fouché will be here. It's Wednesday already. We'll talk with the editor of the dailyline.net about some of the things happening in Chicago and Springfield. Chicago, of course, Chicago Public Schools. Yesterday, a vote of no confidence for Forrest Claypool. A lot of mudslinging. Why are you focusing on us when you should be focusing on Springfield? That's what the city says, the Chicago Teachers Union. We'll also talk about why education, where education funding comes into play when it comes to the budget and increased taxes down in Springfield. And of course, we'll talk about what it means that yesterday we raised the income tax in bill form. We're still a long way to go. And what it takes to get a balanced budget out of Springfield before the end of May. We'll talk about that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, one of Chicago's greatest artists, Frank Maugrey, will be here. Frank's a longtime artist and theater performer and artistic director. He's right now working for Chicago Children's Theater, but he's got a long history here in Chicago, including a stint at the Red Moon Theater. You remember Red Moon? Red Moon, of course, defunct now, but the great puppet-slash-spectacle art theater company. They were well known for the Day of the Dead parades they used to do in Logan Square. And, of course, they're sort of, I would say, mildly mediocre, C-plus Chicago Fire parade spectacle on the river. Remember that, like, maybe 2 years ago? Do you remember that, Pete? Yeah, they did. They were going to do boats, and there were going to be fire. There's going to be a big spectacle thing, and the mayor was putting a ton into the anniversary of it, and they did it, and it rained, and it didn't work. It doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about. It's like how quick we devolve. It's just like fall into. And you remember the fire itself in 1871? Frank Maugrey, be my guest. We'll talk about spectacle and creating theater and art here in Chicago. Also tonight, Laura Kipnis. We talked about that with Roe and Anna, the author of Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campuses. Talk a lot about the sexual politics on campus and her story, which is pretty intense. So she'll be my guest coming up at 9 o'clock. And, of course, Greg Flam tonight. Swap meet. It's Wednesday already. I'm so excited. Always, always great when Greg comes in studio. We will evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, and your junk. 312-981-7200. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. We have so many people coming in from LitFest. I know Ro makes fun of us for it. But I took a picture today and put it on Instagram. There's going to be a brand new, it's amazing. It's probably 8 authors coming through. And they all sent me their books today. So I have to read, I think it is 8 books before June 6th.
Yeah, and there's not like an old man in the sea in the bunch. No. They're all pretty thick.
The more esteemed the writer, the bigger the book.
Yeah.
All right, let's do the carryout. All right, here are today's top stories. Hey, the CBO dropped a new report today on healthcare. Not since the last Drake album has there been so much anticipation. The Congressional Budget Office says, drumroll, the House healthcare bill will cause 23 million people to be uninsured in the next decade, 14 million by the next year. Wait. Never mind. Delete. I just want the Drake album. I'll stick with the Drake album. Some on the right say that the CBO is politically biased, although it's run by a Republican. Still, this is the office whose job it is to predict what cost new legislation will have to taxpayers. And in this case, 23 million of us won't have to worry about it unless we get sick. Then, well, we're up that one creek without that one paddle. And frankly, I wouldn't get too close to the water or the paddle for fear of disease or splinters, because you're not going to have health insurance to cover. No word on whether or not this will pressure senators to change parts of the bill to lower the risk and, of course, the cost. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos testified in Congress today defending the proposed $10.6 billion cut to after-school programs and other federal programs when it comes to school. She said that the Obama administration threw tons of money in education and has nothing to show for it. So then she went on by, she said that by cutting the budget, they're giving the power of education back to the states. She should say back to the states, except Illinois. I've heard this a few times in a few different areas, education, environment, transportation. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but is there money at the state level for these things? Obviously, I'm speaking of our state, Illinois, but to say that we're cutting $10 billion and now the state has the power that they need to make their own choices, well, won't the state just make the same choice, cut programs, because there just isn't any money? I mean, I'm not trying to be a smartass here. I'm genuinely curious. Is the future of government under this federal government to cut spending and cut taxes so that states can increase both, like we just saw in the state Senate yesterday? So we're going to end up paying the same amount in taxes. It just is an administrative shell game. And I don't know if you've ever played the shell game on the L. You never win. And usually someone tries to rob you. So, right? Let's get local now. Alderman Burke getting all hipster cozy today by suggesting that we could give shelter to the homeless by using tiny houses. Tiny houses, of course, are tiny. And all the rage on HGTV, but he suggested maybe the fad could work to provide housing to those in need. I like it. There's nothing that says fighting homelessness like a toilet that also doubles as a sink slash bed. A new report says that Instagram is the worst social media site for users' mental health. FOMO, fear of missing out, and, quote, compare and despair are both real things that have been reported by users who are on social media, this social media site, for 2 to 3 hours a day. Listen, for the last time, that person who's smiling while wearing something cool, while doing something cool, they hate themselves. All right? It's the ones that complain and take pictures of their injuries are the ones that are cool. All right? Do we got that? Like, if you see someone says, look at this pimple, you should respond, hashtag, will you be my friend? That's just the way it is. The first marshmallow cafe is coming to Rogers Park. Marshmallows only. I didn't know snowflakes could eat marshmallows. Let me Jay Leno-ize that joke for you. I didn't know snowflakes could eat marshmallows because leftist liberals are known to live in that area. And snowflake is the new derogatory term for being liberal that they use on Twitter and the far left, huh? Moving on, Judge Ito dancers. And weather, what a gloomy day. Another one to X off the calendar before the winter arrives. Blah. The Memorial Day weekend, though, rainy, warm, and maybe sunny, maybe not. Cold? I don't know. That's the Downloads Weather Report. In sports, the Cubs are underway against the Giants tonight. Whatever happened to day games at Wrigley? Right? The big dog teams come through, and all we get is we're only going to do a few night games. We're still going to honor our heritage. That goes out the window. They got one tomorrow. I get it, a day game, but that's usually a getaway day. Half the league is playing day games. Anyway, I digress because I seem to be the only one that cares about it. So moving on. They won yesterday on a Schwarber bomb. Hayward and Rizzo, too. The bats coming alive. Lester went the distance yesterday. The pitching coming alive. That just seems to be every Cubs report. Are they coming alive? Is it time they come alive? The bats coming alive? The coaching coming alive? Everyone's coming alive. The Cubs are going out west this weekend, and they're going to dress all 70s because that's, I guess, the best decade to dress as. It's a thing that Coach Madden does. I personally like the aughts, where you can dress like Fallout Boy and Lester Holt. 70s will do. It's better than sideburns. Sox had a day game today, and, well, all that goodwill after the series in Seattle melted away in the Arizona Heat. The Diamondbacks sweep the Sox, who are now only a game up on the Royals for that coveted last place spot in the AL Central. Also, starter Dylan Covey removed for tricep soreness last night, so a DL stint probably in the cards. I don't know what to think about this team right now. So much mental confusion. I guess you just have to recognize that it's like the 2012 Cubs, and we just have to hope that the vets heat up so we can fleece the Astros at the deadline. That's pretty much it for Sox fans. The OTA drama this year for the Bears was useless. Receiver Kevin White didn't participate on Tuesday. Mike Glennon said, hey, this is my year. And it was not only a preview for the 2017 Bears, but also a preview of all the columns that will be playing out during the year. Really? I mean, but think about it. It's all the Bears doing. You don't, when you don't tell the media what's going on, they kind of make it up. Think about it. Have you learned nothing from Trump, John Fox? Good NBA story here. The Minnesota Timberwolves are rumored to be interested in New York Knicks free agent point guard Derrick Rose. The Timberwolves, of course, coached by Tom Thibodeau. Interesting, since it was Rose's injuries that led to Thibs losing his job in Chicago. Maybe coach has Stockholm syndrome. But that would be awesome if Rose went to Minneapolis and just tore it up. Bad choice of words. Not his knees. I mean, the game. I'd love it. Especially if he gave the Warriors the run. And then, like, it was all, they won game one. Timberwolves, what is this? And then Rose hurts his knee and they lose four in a row. Anyway, speaking of the Warriors, no word on whether or not Steve Kerr will be back for the finals, which will start a week from tomorrow. That's almost 2 weeks off for Golden State. Nice work if you can get it. And finally tonight, hey, get this. There's a Top Gun sequel in the works. It's been confirmed by Tom Cruise himself. But the big question every fan, every American is asking, will Tom Skerritt be back? If they don't have Skerritt, I mean, what do they have? For me, if they have Kenny Loggins singing Danger Zone 2, I'm in. That's the carryout from May 24th, 2017. Hey, the rain's ruining our grill. So microwaved ribs tonight. Yum. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is going to be here. We'll talk a little Springfield, a little Chicago, Chicago Public Schools. We'll do our update as we do every Wednesday. Frank Maudry is my guest at the big table. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man. Still basking in the glow of Judy Pilak, even right. though she's left the building. It's just an aura.
That's... And cake. There's a lot of cake.
Wow. The chocolate cake up here is fantastic. And there are quite a few pieces left if you guys want to come
Maybe
up after
come
you're
up
done.
And get it. Yeah.
Can I get that? Is that allowed for guests?
Nobody ever comes up to visit me. I'm up here pretty much all
I'll
by
visit
myself.
You, Rob. I'll hang.
Come on up. You're allowed.
With cake.
Yes. I'll bribe you with cake. It's very good
we'll
chocolate
see if
cake.
If they let me through security.
Yeah. You have to say, there's cake up there. Yeah. You have ID? I don't have ID. I just need cake.
Just don't tell them you know me. You'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. My guest tonight, as every Wednesday, God, it goes like this, Mike.
I know, right? It was like I saw you yesterday, but actually it was last week.
I saw you walk in. I'm like, ugh.
Him again.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line. Great to see you, buddy. All right. So, you know, we talk politics, Chicago, Springfield. We got a lot to talk about. It's been a big week, and we said it's going to be ramping up, and it is. Let's first start in Springfield. Yesterday, we saw the state Senate pass a spending plan. This was attached to a budget that was passed a week before.
Right.
Is this the full package? And I always love having you here because we understand a little bit more the politics that's going on behind this and why it is happening this way.
It is not the full package. It is a package, which is better than no package. It's missing a number of things. It's missing money for CPS. But the really big, giant thing that it's missing is a way to pay off the $14 billion in unpaid bills that the state has racked up over the last couple of years.
The income tax increase will not do it alone.
It is a $5.4 billion increase in revenue. It changes personal income tax from 3.75 to 4.95%. Ooh, that hurts. I mean, it's not, you know, I guess for a lot of people, that's a lot of money. I don't know, for me.
It's 100. It could be, I mean, I did the math on it. I mean, it could be up to, depending on how you get taxed, but it could be up to $100 a month.
Yeah. Actually, it could probably be more because it is actually retroactive to January 1st.
That's why it's going to be $100. Yeah.
Yeah,
right,
so
right.
it's going to rack up quite
for
a bit
first,
of money pretty
fast. For the first year, I think it'd be more than it would be after the fact, but because it's retroactive.
Right. And then it also has a few kind of like not so fun things in there. Like, you know, I know for you, this is a big deal. It's going to have new sales taxes for tattoos and piercings.
Right.
because I know you've got all those back piercings.
Finally, and given the piercing community, what they've been skating by.
I know, right? That's and
I love that's like in the same areas like syntax, like cigarettes, large sodas, piercings. Come on.
And then there's a new tax for satellite TV and Netflix.
Now,
and,
Toy Hutchinson was on Patty Vasquez last night, state senator from South Suburbs, talking about the idea that there were a lot of other things that were in the budget before. There has been a negotiation going on here.
Right.
There was we talked about it last week, right. The home repair tax, and that's been removed.
And, like, there's actually cuts, too.
Yeah.
There's
10% across the...
Well, for universities, 5% right. across the board for everybody else, 10% for universities. And, you know, I mean, this is not a give-it-all-away kind of budget. In fact, you know, it really does take away a lot from the state. And, you know, the Better Government Association really had an excellent article this last week about how Illinois is already cut to the bone. We have one of the smallest per capita governments in terms of number of people, in terms of amount of spending. The state government is smaller than it's been since the 1950s.
So is that a win for Governor Rauner? I mean, that is a win in the sense
that
he
wanted
to
do that. Well,
it
was already on that track for some time. And so the question is, you know, when you kind of rattle your sword and say, or, you know, whatever it is, saber, and there's not enough cuts, you know, there's all this waste in government. The truth is, Illinois government is pretty slim and trim. So at this point, you know, really, when you're making cuts, you're not cutting to the bone, you're cutting the bone. And the biggest things that cost money in state government at this point are entitlements like Medicare, Medicaid,
pensions.
And prisons
and
pensions,
right.
And pensions and prisons.
Okay, I'm fascinated about the politics because now here we go. These bills, which are still missing some things, some big things that you mentioned, will move on to the House.
Right.
Now, we've heard all sorts of, I mean, the boogeyman in the state of Illinois is Speaker Madigan.
Right.
And everyone is on watch of how he's going to change it and how he's going to be an obstacle, an obstructionist to be able to get this done. But it seems to be in the House's best interest to pass this along to Governor Rauner because they get their tax increase. And the, like you said, the tax or the cuts are manageable.
Here's the pressure. The one thing that's going on in terms of to make it pass is that the business community has really united and said, get this done, move something. We've got to make this happen. The Chicago Commercial Club, the Chicago Chamber, the Illinois Chamber, they have all said, look, whatever it is that you do, just get something passed, please.
Because, and I read this in an article, that it's not a lack of a budget that is scaring away businesses. It's uncertainty.
It's absolute uncertainty.
So if you have a budget, even if it's a bad budget, it's better for Illinois businesses that they know there's not political uncertainty.
Right. And so, you know, let's remember the deadline for the budget is May 30th,
yeah,
I don't know,
right.
Whatever. And so then the other part is that Governor Rauner has said, well, I will sign this if there is going to be a property tax freeze
right.
for some period of time. Now, you know, Democrats have said, you know, really, we don't want to do a property tax freeze because if there's a property tax freeze, that basically means that local government is going to have to start cutting like mad. That's the main way that we fund local government, schools, towns, city of Chicago. It's through property taxes. And if you can't raise property taxes in any way, then, you know, these places.
Now, there are, and we've talked about it in this segment and in the show. I mean, there are disproportionate property taxes. If you go to McHenry County, you go to the South Suburbs, there are, it's off the, I mean, it's crazy to think about how much money
people are paying. Places that don't have a lot of commercial or manufacturing to rely
on. He's playing to his base in some of those situations, and some of those South Suburbs are Democrat, but the concept being that's what he's talking about. But there's a lot of other places, and we've talked about it, that city of Chicago, maybe even downstate, that aren't necessarily maxed out or capped out when it comes to property taxes.
You know, I think it depends on where you are. You know, I hear stories about Peoria and Springfield, and I hear they're pretty rough in terms of property taxes there proportionally. But, you know, I think that's true. I think certainly south of I-80, property taxes are a much bigger issue than north of I-80. And that plays really, really well for Governor Rauner. The problem is that there are definitely places, If you look at most of the suburbs in Cook County south of I-55, they are going to get ruined in the next couple of years if they don't have a way in order to increase their revenues.
Because of their own pension issues and other things.
Their own
like
pension
that.
Issues, but also because the value of the properties have been declining, and the ability for those municipalities and school districts to be able to increase property taxes, they're already capped out. They can't go anywhere, and so the property values decrease. That means that they can tax less. They get less money to operate. There's a good number of school districts in the South Cook suburbs that are going to go bankrupt.
Mike Fouché, the editor of Daily Line, we can hear him on the him and his crew on the Aldercast on Fridays at WGN Plus. We'll take a break. Come back. We'll continue the conversation. I want to talk about CPS Chicago. Like you mentioned, education funding not in this package. What does that mean for not only the end of this year, which we know it's cha-ching, it's
right.
plastic,
cha-ching.
But let's talk about next year and years to come.
Sure.
Mike Fouché, stay with us.
Nice.
Mike Fouché. Daily Line. Okay, so let's keep this conversation going. We got about 8 minutes here. CPS, let's go quick into this. You know, like you said, I mean, there's no funding yet coming out of Springfield.
No.
CTU has a vote of no confidence for Forrest Claypool.
Yeah.
Karen Lewis at the City Club yesterday.
She wailed on him.
She is so – it's
unloaded.
So fun to listen to her because she's a quote machine.
Yeah.
But she then says, I don't like Claypool. We don't like – he doesn't call me. I don't like him. We like the other one. We like Jackson.
Right.
And the
education officer.
Yeah. And I guess and Claypool and Rahm Emanuel's response was, you know, we got some serious issues with Springfield right now. All hands on deck.
Right.
Why are you trying to fight us when you should be fighting them?
It is a mystery to me. I interviewed the vice president of CTU a couple weeks ago, Jesse Sharkey, which you can listen to on the Aldercast. And one of the things that I asked him about again and again and again is, why can't you guys work together in Springfield? And why do you have so many problems with Claypool and you don't really have problems with the mayor? And, you know, he couldn't really answer why they have problems with Claypool, not the mayor. And I kept asking, you know, these two guys have been working together since the early 80s. I mean, Forrest Claypool and Rahm Emanuel go back.
Claypool is Emanuel's hatchet man.
Well,
I mean, he parked district.
But they're also buddies.
Yeah, right.
They're buddies.
Right.
And
he calls on when he wants to clean up an organization or administration.
The idea that Rahm Emanuel and Forrest Claypool, there's daylight between the two of them, doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't really understand why CTU keeps pummeling Forrest Claypool, and then they were like, oh, but Rahm is okay. Or not okay, we can work with him. So the point that they keep making, though, is that you can't take Chicago seriously, the city of Chicago seriously, until the city raises revenues by about $500 million and puts that into schools. And, you know, if you look at the math, it's true. I mean, the school system has about a $1 billion deficit that it's going to be walking into next year. Forget getting through this year. As soon as the school year's over on June 30th, they're going to have a $1 billion deficit to work with.
Just right like that.
At the beginning.
Yes.
So, you know, I think the argument that CTU is making is, look, these guys are keeping their head in the sand. They're not actually addressing the real problem.
We all see this. I mean, we've talked about it, but we have talked about it. It's not this year, next year, then year after.
Right.
I mean, the pension responsibilities are
right.
intense. They only get more intense.
Yeah.
So why isn't there been a sit down to say we need comprehensive change in the way we do school budget? Why does Emanuel and Claypool keep their head in the sand?
I think
is it just too overwhelming for them? You know, that's the only thing you can pull away.
Out. All they do is play video games when they go home.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I think that probably the one thing that makes any sense to me is that they're trying to keep the train going, barreling forward. So with an idea that to put pressure on Springfield, so that Springfield will write a check in order to bail them out. I don't at this point, it doesn't seem like that's realistic. And there is another part, too, that the schools have to take in, which is that they have to pay for stuff on their own. The city has to pay some amount of money. And I think that from their thinking, the bargaining position goes away as soon as the schools start actually, as soon as, you know, Chicagoans start paying for themselves.
Yeah. All right, my last thought tonight, we kind of mentioned this in the carryout as well, was, you know, everyone's looking at the Trump administration budget that was out and the cuts.
Right.
A lot of which would affect the block grants that come to cities, including Chicago, and there'd be a lot of cuts to this area.
Right.
This is the skinny budget, and then this one. We've seen this, and there wasn't necessarily...
The feds, yeah.
You don't necessarily... Everything that they propose is what's going to get through into budget, so right away the hysteria needs to damp down a little
bit. It's pretty much DOA at this point.
Yeah. But the question I have is that the fundamental concept of the Trump administration saying we're going to cut funding across the board, we're going to cut services, we're going to do everything, because we're going to give you a certain amount of money back to the states.
Right.
And you have the freedom to do whatever you want with it. I mean, this concept is one that has been done before, but at the same time is a change in how we kind of do government.
So The person who did this was really well was Ronald Reagan in his 81 and 82 budgets. There used to be very stringent limitations on all kinds of federal grant money, federal money that went to states and municipalities. And it was all based on headcount. You know, for you get 100 people, you get $100 per person. You know, it worked like that. And then what Reagan did is that he changed it to block grants. He changed a lot of things to block
grants.
And
we still use that today.
And we still use them. And the idea was is that we're going to get rid of this regulation, but we're going to give you less money, but you'll have more freedom to do with what you want.
Because of no regulation.
There was, you know, to some extent.
I understand that, yeah.
Yeah, that was helpful in some ways. There was less money, but it was helpful in some ways.
So what does this do to change it?
Now, fast forward, you know, we're 30 years later. Is that what it is? 35 years later. What really is the case is that states have figured out how to use these systems. They don't need to have less restrictions because they've gotten very savvy. They know how to work the system. They've got these huge healthcare programs, Medicaid programs that work within the federal budget systems. And that isn't as big an issue. So I'm not really sure what the freedom aspect is.
But the idea right now is, that's what the sale is. The sale is we'll give the when it comes to schools, education, and environment, all the things down the line, we'll give you choice, we'll give you freedom, we'll give you the chance to spend the money.
Yeah.
But the question is, states don't necessarily,
they've already made the choices. They pretty much know how to do their stuff. There's not a whole lot of lifting of burden that's going on here.
Interesting. We'll follow that, of course. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line, dailyline.net. You can also find him, Aldercast, which is the podcast here at WGN Plus. It comes out on Fridays, and he joins us every Wednesday here on The Download. Next Wednesday, we'll have an understanding of what happened with the Springfield session being wrapped up.
More stuff.
So lots to talk about. We'll see you next Wednesday. Thanks,
Mike. Looking forward to it.
847 Mary, she says, whenever I hear Mike Fouché on your show, I think how similar his last name is, Fouché to Touche, which is your segment you do with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Maybe you can do a segment called Fouché on Touche, where Mike is the referee.
But he's a fact-based guy. You know, he doesn't speculate. He's hardcore.
He doesn't use those big words.
No. He's a nuts and bolts kind of guy.
Fouché on Touche.
Yeah.
I think it's
great. You never know.
when it becomes the next television, when CNN comes in and says, you know what, we want to spin off, you know, the Download segments. Maybe we can work them together, and that could be a Fouché and Touche.
For a great resource, the Daily Line does a fantastic job. I mean, they really know their stuff.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in this next week. I'm fascinated with what is going to happen here because, I mean, Rauner can say that he's got to win if a budget gets passed, finally, because he could say, you know, spending is down, the government is smaller, I win. But he also, and this may not be the case, that he's going to get property tax relief out of it. And if it goes to his desk and he vetoes it because there isn't property tax relief. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine that?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Rob. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Laura Kipnis is here. She is the Northwestern University professor who wrote the book Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campuses. We'll talk about Title IX and her run-in, writing an essay for an academic journal that caused a lot of uproar on campus, you may remember, and she has now taken that experience and put it to book. We will talk to her. She's at the Chicago Humanities Festival this week, so... Laura Kipnis coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. And Swap Meet, Greg Flam will be here, 312-981-7200. Well, today the Chicago Children's Theater announced their 2017-2018 season. So what about it? Well, this is the first season for the outstanding Chicago company with a new permanent home. The Station is a redeveloped police station in the West Loop, and it's now a place for shows, classes, exhibits, and events. The Chicago Children's Theater boasts that it's the largest professional theater company in Chicago, exclusively designed for families. In its 12th year, the company's gone from just doing theater to entrenching themselves in the community with spectacle work, events, collaborations with local schools. The company has always been top-notch. I love it. My family has been to a number of shows there. And it's only solidified its reputation when Frank Maudry came over to run community programs. He's been the community program's artistic director for a little over a year. You may recognize Frank's name. He's been at the forefront of creating community around theater for years, including his time at the now-defunct Red Moon Theater. If you recall, Red Moon was one of Chicago's best theater companies. It was hired to do the big Chicago fire show on the river a few years back. But times change. The theater company is now in our memories, but Frank continues that work in his new role at Chicago Children's Theater. And it's my pleasure to welcome great Chicago artist, Frank Maudry, to the big table. Frank, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I saw you this morning getting your hair cut on WGN Morning
News.
I did.
I took advantage of the opportunity to have my hair trimmed in front of how many people watch that particular show.
Well, I think it speaks to how important the Chicago Children's Theater is that you make an announcement today that the new season is out and you got media at your place, you're on the radio. I mean, you're everywhere. Talk about the new season. How exciting is it over there to not only have new work but to have it in a new home?
Well, I think it's remarkable, actually, and Jackie Russell has worked tirelessly to find a home for the Children's Theater, and the fact that it lives in what is an old police station has tremendous symbolism and a great message of hope for young people, that anything can transform and become something that it was not originally. And again, she's put together a really lovely, special season for kids and families that includes the production A Year with Frog and Toad, which I saw some years ago, and it was perfectly beautiful and enchanting and of great integrity. Beatrix Potter Holiday Party is the next show in the season, and that's a really special toy theater work directed by Will Bishop and designed by Grace Needleman, two very special artists, followed by My Wonderful Birthday Suit, which is a world premiere, An Epic Tale of Scale, another world premiere, and Last Stop on Market Street, the third world premiere in this upcoming season. So that's incredible. And to have it all consolidated in our home, obviously, will be good for everybody.
What does that do for a company? How important is it for a theater company to have a permanent space?
Well, you know, I think it's especially important for a company to have its own home, especially a company like the Children's Theater, which is focused on creating a safe environment for children to express themselves boldly and bravely. So to have a home that we can make sure that that can happen respectfully and responsibly is really essential. But secondly, we can really build upon our creative imagination by ever evolving the tone of the building and the objects in the building and the way the space feels to really work in collaboration with the season's goals and themes.
Well, you talk about collaboration. I mean, the school, you've got a school right next to you, but the idea of a theater company surrounded by a community. I mean, how important is it for the theater company to be entrenched in a neighborhood, not necessarily on a theater row like Randolph or even, you know, some of the theaters that are along Lincoln Avenue? How important is it for you to not only have a new space, but to have it involved in a working community?
I think there's two things there, and I find it to be a particularly exciting question. One, I think the choice of that building in that neighborhood was very, very smart. Not only the history of the building itself in relationship to what it says currently to young people, but that neighborhood has a really interesting developing community, especially of little kids. You know, the number of 3 to 5 year olds in that community is enormous. It's remarkable. And the opportunity to provide them really unusual educational experiences and dynamic challenging children's shows will participate in shaping the way they see the world and the way they participate as citizens, which really gets to the next point, which is all theaters have a responsibility to be neighbors. We all have responsibility to be good community members. Mm-hmm. Our job really is to create platforms for others to express themselves with comfort and safety and discipline. And I think, you know, what we started to do long before we entered into the West Loop was create partnerships with as many neighbors as we could and fundraise ourselves to provide them generally free programming so that we could build relationships with them and introduce them to the station and guide them to what would be a safe place for their later expression. Additionally, it's important for us to make sure that as many children from throughout the Chicago landscape surrounding suburbs feel like that's their home too. So the goal is to create a destination space that really feels like a place where young people can author not only the skill of playmaking, but their own vision as human beings, citizens, neighbors, and civic entities.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back. I want to get into that idea of civic engagement, but also, you know, what having a theater space that's designed not just for children's shows, but for classes, for camps, for events, what that does when you expose children to arts and culture like that, especially at such a young age, 3, 4, 5 years old, as you mentioned. Frank Maudry's in studio. He is the Community Programs Artistic Director for the Chicago Children's Theater. Today they announced their 2017-2018 season, which will all take place in their new home, The Station, a renovated police station at 1000 South Racine, right there, 1001? What is the 100 South Racine, right in the heart of the West Loop. Frank Maudry, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Frank Maudry in studio tonight. He's a Community Programs Artistic Director for the Chicago Children's Theater, who announced today their 2017-2018 season. And the importance of that is that it's in their new home on the near west side, in the West Loop, 101 South Racine. It's the place called The Station, a former police station. Everyone I know who goes, oh, that's a theater now? They're like, I spent a night in there. Because that used to be the police station for the United Center. So if you got too drunk at a hockey game and things didn't work out in your favor, they sent you to where you guys are doing children's theater.
We often have fathers come into the station who like to brag, I remember this place. I was here for one night. And I thought maybe someday we should have T-shirts for parents that say, I was here for a night. And then kids could have shirts that say, I was here for 2 weeks of summer camp or whatever it was. But I don't think that's right for the brand.
There's something really intriguing about the idea of transformation, especially from this building, because that whole area, when you think about the near west side of Chicago, all it has been in the last 100 years has been transformation. At one point along Union Park, and it used to be very affluent. Then you had a spell in the mid-century, 20th century, that it was the slums. I mean, that was the west side ghetto. And now you see a transformation again with the West Loop, and you see so many buildings coming up, Google, McDonald's, other places coming in, making it desirable, affluent once again. So there's something about the neighborhood. How do you fit in when you talk about transformation and taking a building like a police station and turning it into a children's theater?
I mean, there's so much there, right? The first piece is, it's true that only 20 years ago, Madison Street was what any, you know, old alcoholic or junkie might talk about being, you know, the most derelict street in the city of Chicago. And now that street is radically transformed. Now, this is in part because of its how close it is to the city of Chicago, how much Chicago is changing in general, though there are still pockets around it that suffer significantly. And hopefully those will see change as well over time and hopefully soon. But you know, the transformation of that whole neighborhood and that space is extraordinary, and it's moving quickly, right? Like Wicker mm-hmm. Park took a long time, or Logan Square took a long time, and the West Loop seems to be just like speedily moving forward in terms of affluency, but importantly, open-mindedness. So, you know, the purely affluent neighborhood may not necessarily have liberal associations or comfort with expression or wide open embrace to arts. And this neighborhood does. You know, a majority of the parents who now attend the station either for a production or for one of the classes mm-hmm. are really excited, open-minded, interesting people, and the community is representing that, right? The Merritt School of Music, mm-hmm. and Soul City Church, I think, is really extraordinary in terms of the number of people who participate there and the way that that faith operates there, and even a little place, small places like the way Snippets operates as civic engagers, or Warm Belly, which is an incredibly active
cafe
cookie shop that really is interested in seeing the neighborhood transform for all the right reasons. It's just incredibly socially conscious.
How do you come into that? I mean, when you take a building and you have a design and you say, we're going to do this, you bring an architect in and you decide to transform a police station into a theater. How much of it is the vision of the architect and the vision of the company, and how much of it, if it wants to be a center of the community or part of the community, does the community have input in?
Well, I think there's two pieces to that. One, I was not here when Jackie and the team of architects designed the space. But I know it was an extensive process, and there was a lot of labor involved in it. Just the cleaning of the debris of what was a police station, right? That's part one. And what they did was create a great shell for the opportunity for community to come in and decide over time what it should feel and what it should look like. And I really like that balance, meaning, for instance, that, you know, when we moved in now only 4 months ago, 4.5 months ago, it has not been very long. It really was a safe, clean, comfortable building. And now as we've been building audience for productions and we've been building classes full of children and we've begun to host camps that are really successful and more, those people and their identities and their interests and their culture and their beliefs are beginning to creatively infiltrate the way the building looks and feels. And I think that's really interesting in that it provided them a platform for their own personal expression without saying, what do you think this building should look like?
Yeah.
Instead, it's a natural, often subconscious or unconscious conversation about, you know,
I can only think to the work that you've done in the past. I mean, mm-hmm. I think of Red Moon, even when you had the last space that was on, was 22nd or 23rd.
In Pilsen.
You know, the industrial takeover of the warehouse that you guys took over, it was gritty. It had a feel to it, and it sort of stuck itself to Red Moon Theater, or Red Moon stuck itself to it. But the idea that the space defined or became part of the identity of the theater company.
Well, space is an informant. You know, generally, that's why set designers make sets for directors, right? Because the space defines the experience, the theme, the direction that you're going to go into in terms of what story you're telling. And a building is just a story, right? So how you enter this building is through, everyone enters through the same ramp, so that be it someone who is very capable of walking and someone on a wheelchair enter the same door. And that was principle for Jackie. And I think that's really impressive that she wanted to create a building that was truly inclusive and fought hard to make sure that, you know, everyone got to participate in the building fully without feeling like their disability would limit them from participating, mm-hmm. Including anyone can get up to the top floor through the elevator to participate in the courses and classes, so that our camps and our classrooms are full of people who are very, very different from one another, which is an essential part of the mission there, which is to bring together folks who would not normally mix to create artistic product that hopefully tells a new story about our city and about themselves.
I love it. I mean, I love the Chicago Children's Theater and the work that you've done. I've had, you know, artists on the show talking about it, but I also love the thought that goes into building a new theater and inclusivity and the things that have to go into that you wouldn't even think about when you're putting a building together, building a condo or building anything else. The idea that that's great. Frank Maudrea is the community programs artistic director for Chicago Children's Theater. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get a news break with Rob Martier. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the new season. But I really want to talk about your career as well. I mean, you, of course, with Red Moon Theater, had made an impact on this town through what you did with Spectacle, what you did with the parades in Logan Square and Humboldt Park, and even what you did downtown on the river in the Chicago Fire event. Frank Maudrea, my guest in studio, will continue the conversation. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio, Frank Maudry. He is the Community Programs Artistic Director for Chicago Children's Theater, a longtime theater artist and director. He was one of the guys behind Red Moon Theater. Red Moon Theater, and I want to talk to you about that, and a lot of people listening will know Red Moon Theater for all of the spectacle that you guys did. It went defunct, 2 years ago now?
It's almost 2 years, yeah.
Do you miss it?
Of course I miss it. I mean, my life happened there. I met my wife there. I met some of my best friends there. I had an enormous collaborative, creative community that I got to work with, and the privilege to create remarkable work in complicated places and difficult circumstances. And, you know, as I'm emerging back into the theater scene and preparing to direct shows and design shows, you know, I was at an event recently, 2 weeks ago. Casey Foster, the wonderful actress who works with Looking Glass often now, does dance tributes. And her dance tribute was a tribute to Mark Messing. And there were 90 performers in the show. And two things happened. One, probably 80 of them were interns at Red Moon at some point and had evolved through the Red Moon mechanism into their own performance spectacle art makers. That was really interesting. And probably 50% of the music that was played that evening from Mark's library was made for Red Moon shows in some context. And it really, as difficult as that was, interestingly, it was also incredibly inspiring and relieving to know that Red Moon had made such a impact, not only on the city and the viewers and the audience, but makers too. And I really do believe that, you know, what's happening right now is Red Moon was so fertile that it's going to grow, new artists and new things will happen, and that'll be great.
There's not a company in Chicago, and I don't want to put down anybody who's doing it because I'm sure there are, but the spectacle with a capital S, I mean,
I don't think there's anyone in the nation
that
I think
did what you guys did. Not I mean, only a lot of the works were not on a stage. They were on a street. They were a parade. There were, huge puppets. And just when we say spectacle, really spectacle. I mean, amazing stuff that was home here in Chicago. And as an artist, or anybody who knew Chicago in the 90s and 2000s, you're like, yeah, Chicago is home to Red Moon.
It's home to this kind of thing, I think. You know, I mean, times have changed in Chicago. When I entered the art scene in the late 80s, not to date myself, but it was a really, you know, the avant-garde was hot and it was popular and it was big and people were hungry for adventurous theater that was non-narrative and it was visually based and it was risky and dangerous. And that was what Chicago felt like for a long time. It's found a bit of a more mainstream trail in the past 10 or 15 years, which is totally okay. It's understandable as it evolves. But Red Moon was really born out of that and within that particular period of time that was really exciting and strange and cool.
It was very cool. I mean, I think about the spectacle, and I think it was right around Halloween that you would do the spectacle parades.
We would do the All Hallows Eve rituals.
And the amount of work that you'd have to put into that. And as someone who, you know, has been in theater and paid attention, to watch you guys do that and to watch the amount of spirit that not only came in the production and the presentation and performance, but the way that the communities responded. And it wasn't just a community of affluent white people in the North Side. It was a community that was diverse, that felt like this was normal. This is the idea that arts in Chicago and on the street, this is what this town's all about.
And, you know, I think part of that, you know, is really the result of us sharing a mission of authentically wanting people to have a platform to express themselves. And we were really excited about the clumsy, difficult, chaotic, results that came with that kind of collaboration, because it's not easy. And I don't think many people want to go into that kind of collaboration. The theater scene generally is there's a director and he tells a bunch of people what to do. And there's some people who will challenge that a bit more and say, okay, we're an ensemble. We're going to figure out this show together. Mm-hmm. But there's still generally a kind of subtle, generous tyranny at play.
And, but Red Moon was hundreds of people.
It was hundreds of people. And often nights you weren't even sure who was directing. And that wasn't unintentional. That was a part of the liquid form of this thing. It moved, you know, like a big giant snake. And when it was great, it was incredible. And when it wasn't, it wasn't.
Well, you're setting yourself up for, you know, people might remember Red Moon getting the opportunity to do the Chicago Fire Celebration, which was down on the Chicago River, big thing. Mayor Emanuel brought you guys in to do this project to essentially light fires on the river. I mean, it was an amazing thing that you guys were trying to pull off, and it didn't really work. The fires didn't light. There were crowds that I didn't even expect that many people. I remember being in the newsroom at a different place going, and they're going, is anyone covering this? I'm like, why would anyone cover this? This is going to be... It'll be okay. There were thousands of people down there.
The crowd was incredible. And you know, this story, we all write our own narrative, right? Some of us rewrite narratives to serve ourselves. Some of us write narratives to serve true history. And one thing failed that evening. The houses did not burn down. Mm-hmm. And that was a critical element, obviously. I would never argue that it wasn't. But the number of things that succeeded outside of that single element, the number of communities that we went into and made food with and for, the number of people who had the opportunity to say what they were resilient toward and how their lives could be different, the number of pieces of art that we made with young emerging artists. I mean, right. the entire event was galactic in the number of people who needed to participate, collaborate, and author the whole thing. And so its civic impact was, in my opinion, undeniable. But there was a feature that really brought it to its knees, sadly. And that's too bad that the narrative is so marred by that one.
Why do you think that
is?
I mean, I think that will be in any piece of any process that's art. At the end of the day, they're going to judge what was the outcome at the moment that the house was supposed to burn down, right? That, I mean, because you're right. There's a million things that went right that night, one thing that didn't. When you're dealing with that kind of situation as an artist, as a organizer, director, all the things that you are and have been for Red Moon and for the city, what's going through your mind?
Well, I think it was different for everybody. The core people who worked on that project. And surprisingly, even 2 years later, I don't love talking about it. But I think about it every day. And what it did for me was that it provided me an opportunity to deeply feel failure, to deeply feel regret in the moment, and powerlessness. Nothing I could have done. Now, all of us thought, like, maybe I should jump in the river and swim over there and light the house with a match. Like, we, you know, it was crazy making on some level in that way. But it also helped me understand that, and this is the most important lesson now, 2.5 years later, that you can fail epically, but if you get back up and if you work hard and if you're generous to people and if you design a mission for yourself and if you continue to be of service, this was my wife's note, the way that you will return to art successfully is by finding ways to be of service. Don't serve yourself, serve the city and serve its community members. And I think that makes sense. And that's how I've kind of evolved through the process, was to see the fact that we are remarkably resilient. And I think it's a Chicago thing. Like, I've often wondered if another company was doing this in another city, would they pick themselves up and survive? Right. Maybe not. I mean, Chicago is so well known for we roll up our sleeves, we hike up our boots, and we move.
Right. And there's an element of risk. I mean, that's one of the great things. And even pointing to the conversation we've already had tonight, when you talk about the idea of this being an avant-garde city, that people know this work, this spectacle, they expect it. And it has taken a mainstream turn. But sometimes the avant-garde doesn't go the way it's planned. It's not a Broadway musical. It's not a prepared city New Year's Eve celebration. There's some argument to say that, you know, the proper place for a Red Moon Theater Company is not on the river downtown Chicago. the proper places in Logan Square, or Humboldt Park, or in Pilsen, and the areas that you guys served and you served so well for years. Because as a fan of your company and as a fan of Chicago art, I don't at all. I remember that story, and I think there's a Schadenfreude to it in the way that it didn't work and people chuckled. But there's no lasting impact in my mind that that sullies the name Red Moon. You know what I mean?
I think that's really true, and I appreciate you saying that, as I assume many people would, because those who were close to Red Moon, the board and the core artists, it was everything to us. And we really believed and knew it could be something significant. And it was, you know, it didn't peter out. It didn't quietly go away. It really stood for what it meant to stand for. And in the end, you know, there wasn't really ultimately a model for that kind of thing. And that was okay. I think everyone's going to find their voice again because it was a dynamic group of people and we all share one mission in common. My narrative about Red Moon was always that, you know, people would come and people would go. And the people who would go were usually people who didn't necessarily share the social mission. They were artists who wanted to author their own work or whatever it looked like. But the people who stayed were the people who had dynamic core social missions about engaging our city civically and making art that was transformative. Those people stayed through the tough stuff, but there's still the avant-garde's a funny thing, right? It sits, it rests, it haunts in the shadows. I mean, Blair Thomas has created a remarkable puppetry festival, and a majority of that work sits in the avant-garde. And there's, you know, great artists around Chicago who are still walkabout theater. A young company is really finding a way to express themselves without language and primarily through image, or a Lucky Plush. I mean, there's companies that are inviting and at the same time very courageous with their content. So it's there for sure. And, you know, it might be a little quiet now, but
I was going to say Chicago's kids get the good fortune of working with you at the Children's Theater. But what's next for you for spectacle, for adults? I mean, you just mentioned other people and other people from Red Moon, and you've talked about, you know, it's 2.5 years. Are you thinking about getting back into the game of creating and doing the things that you did before?
Well, I appreciate that question. I mean, I intentionally took this opportunity with the Children's. It was provided to me, and I was very grateful for it, and I still am, last March. So, you know, I've been in the position now for 14 or 15 months. It feels like yesterday, interestingly enough. And my endeavor then was, I'm going to build the structures for a successful revenue-generating business for this company so that funds are coming in consistently and serving the institution's artistic mission. And I'm still doing that. It's going very well, and I'm really proud of the results that we have, and I'm really very proud of the team that I've constructed, and more, and the community work that we're doing. It's really exciting. Of course, internally as an artist, I long to make ritual and I long to make puppetry, and I plan to do those things in some way, shape, or form in the future. I'm directing a show for the Actors Gymnasium that I'm really excited about. And, you know, I'm creating a few small intimate shows for an event that I'm going to do here later in the fall. And, you know, the challenge is to rightly balance my obligation to the Children's Theater, and then, you know, work in my studio. So what's exciting to me with this new life that I've been given, which it really is a chance to go back in the studio like I did when I was a young artist and tinker and break and think and play. And that's a huge gift for me because, you know, Red Moon was a big business. There wasn't a lot of time to sit and think like, what's cool. I mean, we were churning out the spectacle at a rapid rate on very few resources and a really small team. So to be back in the studio and just be playing with a mechanical thing and thinking, what could this story be over a long arc, is thrilling.
And this is a great place for us, you know, as I ask you one last question, just the concept of tinkering, playing, thinking, going into the studio. When I think about those things and the way you said it, I mean, there are lessons to be taught to children, and there's always going to be a political argument about whether or not art should be funded or art should be a federal program and otherwise, but there shouldn't be any question of how important the artistic process and arts are to a kid, to children's lives. And I think you just nailed it right there with tinkering, playing, figuring it out, brushing yourself off when something doesn't work, and learning the lessons that come with being an artist.
I think there's so much there, Justin, and part of it is, You know, we're losing a sense of play, and we have been for a long time, especially with screens, iPhones, iPads. Like, kids are losing a sense of what it means to kick a can, to play in an alley, to just be with one another in an unexpected, surprising, imaginative manner. So play becomes core to the work we need to do as citizens and human beings on Earth. That's part A. Part B is, you know, I like theater, and sometimes I love theater, but my interest isn't necessarily to ultimately train the next generation of theater makers. My interest is to take what theater provides to young people, which is voice, expression, confidence, clarity, the ability to speak, to be passionate, to present themselves well. This is what being an actor really means. Now, put that next to design, which is as equally important to me as good acting skills. Design is all about resourcefulness, creativity, imagination, breaking something, putting it back together. When you collide those two things together, what you're providing young people is a chance to become themselves more fully, to be able to step on a stage and speak about what their personal belief and mission is, represent themselves with articulation, and then be able to solve problems and think new ways about how something that was something can be something else. So in the end, we're building greater citizens. And there's no more important social mission on the planet, in my opinion, than to really be considerate of our greatest natural resource, which are our children, and to train them to be visionaries, educators, believers, and thinkers of the next generation. And I think theater really, when taught well, offers all of those skills. And they can be a great actor, too.
Yeah, there you go. Frank Maudry is the Community Programs Artistic Director for the Chicago Children's Theater. They just announced their 2017-2018 season at their new space, The Station, 101 South of Racine in the West Loop. They've got summer camps and classes and things. You can go to the website, Chicago Children's Theater. Just Google it. Frank, of course, longtime artist, theater maker, spectacle organizer. Frank, great to talk to you. Thanks for being my guest, and I appreciate
Thank you so much.
Good combo there, Frank Maudry. Yeah, I mean, that was, I didn't really plan to spend too much time talking about the Red Moon Theater Chicago Fire Festival. That didn't go as planned. That was a big deal. I a couple of people texted in remembering it. Yeah, I mean, but I'm glad that he talked about it. I'm glad he talked about it because I thought it was a great lesson, as he said. You know, when you really have to look failure, his words, not mine, and you have to figure out how you're going to dust yourself off and get back up. If there's not lessons in there, I don't know what is. Tomorrow night at the big table, the new FOP president, the Fraternal Order of Police president, Kevin Graham, going to be in studio. We'll talk for an hour about police, about policing communities here in Chicago, the Department of Justice report. Lots to talk about. I'm so excited to have him here. That's a great, great big table guest. Lots to talk about. We've been talking about it on this program. And he's the brand new FOP president. He beat Dean Angelo in the vote, the election, not too long ago. So Kevin Graham will be my guest tomorrow night here on The Download. Much more to come tonight. Laura Kipnis coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. The Northwestern professor found herself in the middle of a controversy after writing an academic essay, an academic journal, about essentially pushing back on the what she calls sexual politics on the campus. There was a memo that came out that said professors can't date students, and she did a essay that was essentially saying, you know what? What are we doing here? Well, we don't need to regulate this stuff. She got so much blowback, so much pushback. At one point, got a Title IX complaint. She had created a hostile learning environment, and she took that whole experience, including the Title IX investigation, and she wrapped it all up in her book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia on Campuses. That's coming up. We'll talk with her after the 9 o'clock news. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has written a new book called Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Laura Kipnis is a professor at Northwestern University, and she knows the issue firsthand after writing a piece in an academic journal questioning the university's new rules on professor-student dating. The piece argued that university rules and regulations were actually anti-feminist, reinforcing stereotypes and that female students couldn't make choices or needed protection. But some in the student body didn't see it that way, and they protested Kipnis and her article. Not just the old-fashioned protest signs on the quad, nope. A campaign of sorts was mounted to remove her from her job, to shame her on social media, and complain that she created a hostile learning environment. All of that over an essay. And Kipnis is not alone. Through her journey, she uncovered more and more cases of a new sexual reality on college campuses, one where the federal government, Title IX, has run amok with new standards and guidelines that were designed to take on sexual assault on campus, but may have missed the mark and created a new sex-negative culture where students are not given the right to make choices, but instead live in a sexual nanny state. Laura Kipnis currently lives in New York City, but she's back in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and she's my guest tonight. Laura, thanks for being here.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right. So this is a great book. I appreciate you writing this. And I have to ask the question. I mean, it's a book that's about feminism. It's about government regulation. It's about college campuses and how they sort of play out today. But what was it that really pushed you into commenting on this in the first place with the article? What was it that really moved you to get involved in this conversation?
Well, I stumbled into all of this kind of haplessly. I was asked to write an essay for this journal, The Chronicle of Higher Education, which I thought only professors and deans and people like that read. I certainly didn't think students read it. And I was asked to write about sexual politics on campus. And I started thinking about this notice that had been sent around to all of us about a year before that, prohibiting professors and students dating. And I want to make clear, it's not that I am endorsing professors and students dating.
Right.
I'm not pro that sort of relationship. But look around any college campus around the country, and you will find dozens of couples that started out as professor-student. In my own department, there are at least two married couples who started out in professor-student relationships, or professors and former students, let me say. So it's, you know, this was very much an accepted thing. And so to have this new regulation that suddenly criminalizes something that had been taken for granted for so long, it seemed kind of hysterical to me. And so as I was thinking about the situation, I started out somewhat in a somewhat mocking tone about these new regulations and this new layer of regulation that's meant to protect students, particularly women
right.
students, and I think is actually having the opposite effect because it's treating women, it infantilizes students, and it treats women as though we're not capable of making choices. You know, people over the age of consent, I think, should be able to consent to what they want to consent to. So I wrote a kind of, you know, somewhat ironical article pointing out some of those things and talking about a situation on our own campus that was ongoing about a professor that had been accused of sexual misconduct. And so the next thing I knew, students were staging a protest march.
It really is when you think about what, you know, because the idea of professor-student dating, I mean, I think everybody who listens to this will go, yeah, it's probably not a good idea. But there's something on college campuses where you really have to balance letting students make their own choices and be adults, because that's the idea of a college campus. You're getting ready for adulthood. And at the same time, provide protections for the kids in them, the ones that they're still kids. I mean, it's such a complicated issue. And it is interesting that the universities, not just Northwestern, but others as well, are siding on regulation protections and taking away choice.
Well, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, they're trying to cover themselves for sure. And, you know, as everyone knows, there is an issue with sexual assault on campuses, but that's between undergrads and undergrads who, you know, get drunk on weekends and, you know, all sorts of stuff goes on. So there's a problem with the issue of consent and what's consensual, particularly when people have been drinking. But the sort of way these regulations radiate out into all spheres, I mean, sure, I would agree with you that a person in a position of grading power over someone shouldn't be dating that person.
Right.
But if that's not the case, I think that's what's happened as I started thinking about all of this more, is that there's a real shift in the sexual culture from the time that I was in school to the point that I think sex itself is seen as harmful. So situations that, as I was growing up, seemed to be kind of the norm, like, you know, maybe, you know, to use this example, professors and students dating, is now seen as like a priori traumatizing, that the professors are predators and the students are the prey. And so there's this kind of melodramatic framing of these situations. It's no longer in the realm of sort of, you know, human erotics and, you know, the kind of dumb crushes that people have or romantic foibles or whatever. All of a sudden, we're in this world that's full of, you know, predators and their prey. So like I said, as I was writing this article, I started thinking, and the article ended up getting using the term melodrama a lot. So to see things, you know, there are villains and there are victims and it's all very black and white. And so that was the thing I was kind of protesting.
When I think about the story, too, and a lot of the book centers around the story that you wrote about in the article, which is about Professor Ludlow, a philosophy professor who was accused by two different students at two different times about sexual misconduct. And also its relationship to Title IX and the way that the government and regulations came in. You sort of start the story, and I really like this concept with this quote, "Dear colleagues" lettered. We started to see in college campuses from professors and other administrators started to get more and more of these letters from administrators from, I guess, from Title IX, from wherever it says, "Dear colleagues," and essentially more and more regulations started coming down. There was a shift at some point, maybe in the last 5 years, where this started happening.
So what happened was after the student protest, I was brought up on what are called Title IX complaints by two graduate students. And I, like you, had no idea what Title IX was. I thought it had something to do with women's sports. So it turns out the Department of Education issued what you're referencing, this mm-hmm. Dear Colleague letter, which expanded the purview of Title IX from gender equity, like for funding for women's sports, to sexual misconduct. And they sort of mandated that all schools that get federal funding have to run these sort of secret tribunals and adjudications to deal with sexual misconduct, but which can mean anything from harassment or somebody getting groped at a party in a way they don't like to rape to forcible, mm-hmm. you know, sexual assault. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether those kinds of situations really should be handled on campus. I mean, part of the reason for this was there was a feeling that the criminal justice system wasn't taking this stuff seriously enough, or colleges themselves weren't, particularly
right, police, right?
Particularly when it involves like frats or sports teams. So, you know, that something had to be done. And so Title IX, the expansion of it in 2011, following these Dear Colleague letters, was the result. But what a lot of people have come to think is that, you know, the overcorrection has gone so far that, you know, as happened to me, like the idea that a professor can be brought on Title IX complaints
for writing an essay
goes a bit far. And what's also happening, as I started learning, and I can tell you more about that, is that in these adjudications, there's like no due process.
Why don't we do this? We'll take a break here because I want to stay on time tonight. And let's talk about that, because that's a big part of the book, is about regulation and this idea that Title IX and the federal government can come in and pretty much do whatever they like when it comes to investigations. And as you found out firsthand, in studio tonight, Laura Kipnis, who's a Northwestern University professor, film professor, and she's also the author of Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Laura Kipnis, she's a professor at Northwestern. She's written the book Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. We pick up in the conversation talking about Title IX, because at one point they took on the federal government, the Department of Education, Title IX, took on the idea of sexual misconduct falls under that purview. As we know, Title IX to be more about gender equity in sports.
Originally. Yeah.
It's changed. And what you found out, But it is the head scratcher of the book, the idea that you could write an essay in an academic journal and be called on Title IX complaints in front of, you know, investigator. But what you found out was that this was not it did not mirror our justice system. It does not mirror any sort of fair and equitable system that we may know as members of this society. And it also, at the same time, doesn't necessarily mean anything. you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it's really just for them to be able to fully investigate sexual misconduct. there's a lot wrong with the system.
Well, can I just jump in? It's so much doesn't not mean anything because people are losing their jobs. Faculty are losing their jobs. Students who get caught up in these cases, which mostly means male students because this has mostly got to do with heterosexual sexual situations between undergrads, are getting kicked out of school left and right. And this may not be familiar to your listeners because nobody really knows a lot about this stuff because it's all kept confidential. And if you're caught up in one of these procedures, there's a demand that you don't talk about it. So I kind of talked about it because I thought this stuff has to go public and people have to know.
I guess that's what I mean. You're absolutely right. It's very serious. And a lot of what came out of this is the ability for you to become an ear for people to bend after they saw what happened and you publicly were talking about it. So many cases came in. But by pushing back on the Title IX investigation, saying, I'm going to talk about it, I'm going to write about it, I'm going to do whatever, you quickly realize that you could do those things. It's not like they're telling you don't talk about it, but at the same time, there's really nothing they can do to stop you.
Well, I was in a position to talk about it because I have tenure, thank God, at a good university, Northwestern, a research university. Somebody else who was in my position who didn't have job security and talked about their situation could likely get fired. So it depends on the institution. And so I did write about this investigation. I was kind of, summoned to this meeting. They wouldn't tell me the charges. I write about it in the book, all of the kind of, people have used the word Kafkaesque a lot, that kind of experience that it was. And so I wrote a second article called My Title IX Inquisition, right, detailing it. And then I started hearing from people all over the country who had had similar experiences and far worse than mine, because there's so little due process and it's so not transparent. And so, people are summoned to some meeting, presented with a list of things they supposedly have done. They can't bring a lawyer. There are no rules to protect them. And you're often out of a job. If you don't comply, you're out of a job. If you do comply. So things that aren't even against any code, like I've heard from a lot of professors about dating a former student and there was no regulation against it and they end up losing their job. The situations between undergrads, you just often have a situation where two people are equally drunk. And I ended up also thinking there's just a lot of gender bias in these adjudications. So two people are equally drunk. The guy is charged with sexual assault if there's a complaint later, even if there was consent at the time, because you can't under the new rules, you can't consent if there has been alcohol. So that automatically criminalizes the huge percentage of undergraduate sexual activity. So part of the point is that these codes are making like a whole new criminal class on campus and people can't talk about it.
I mean, it's an interesting argument because people, a little pushback would be that with sexual assault and the way that it's played out on campuses for decades, there has been a lack of there has just been a lack of follow through from the campuses. The criminal justice system is not in support. It's really difficult for victims to come forward. The campuses have really dropped the ball. So you can understand why the federal government in the last 5 or 6 years would say, all right, we're going to take this issue on. Yeah. We're going to fix it for all the mistakes that were made by. But in your book, you argue they just went a little too far.
Look, I think that any sort of justice system has to be governed by due process. I mean, we are supposedly still in America, and there is rule of law, and that's what's not happening. And so there needs to be transparency, and there needs to be accountability on the part of the administrators, but there also needs to be public discussion about what is now being called sexual assault. And I think what's happened is that these rules are being expanded and stretched and made up behind closed doors, and nobody really knows about it. So if you found out what students are being charged with these days and kicked out of school over, I think you would be shocked.
In some cases, verbal coercion. Some cases in the book, you even kind of talk about the idea of leering or looking at different students. I mean, there are cases that go that deep into the Title IX stuff.
Illicit eye contact. Or even somebody making a joke that somebody doesn't like in an off-campus bar. I mean, I've heard more than one case like that. and end up, you know, going through some lengthy process or texting. I mean, there was a case I wrote about where a grad student and an undergrad, and this the grad student had no supervisory relation to the undergrad student, had some sexual text messages or sexy texts, you know, whatever. Later the student complained, and there was an 8-month investigation about this. Nobody even touched anyone. These were text messages.
You know, it is, I guess, when you think about what's happening on college campuses and you think about, you know, even when it gets outside of, as you mentioned, off-campus bars, things of that nature, how much of this is a shift in society, meaning that we're seeing a different sort of understanding of what we consider to be sexual misconduct, and how much of it is just sort of, like I kind of mentioned in the beginning, this sort of sexual nanny state on campuses because they don't know how to regulate students who are learning about things that are making the wrong choices, as a lot of students do, and professors that get caught up in the mix.
Yeah, I think that campuses whose, you know, mission is to focus on education have certainly dropped the ball and are focusing on regulation instead. And the regulations, I think, are ineffectual in protecting students who need to be protected or, you know, against sexual assault. But the way to protect them, and particularly incoming freshmen who are the most vulnerable, freshman women, I think, is through education. And, you know, realistic discussions about the kind of stuff that they're going to face and the social scene and the drinking and how not to be coerced into sex you don't want to have. And I think rather than having those tough discussions, instead you have these after-the-fact adjudications and, you know, just like really dropping the, you know, hammer on, if that's the right expression, on, you know, people that have transgressed, slightly kicking them out of school. But I don't think that's making anyone safer, and it's certainly not educating students in how to deal with the realities of life and sexual situations once they're off campus, where regulators aren't standing by to, you know, hold hearings.
Laura Kipnis is a Northwestern professor who wrote the book Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. She's in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get the update on tonight's news, and we'll come back, and we'll continue the conversation with Laura Kipnis. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Laura Kipnis, professor of film at Northwestern University and the author of Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. She's in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. You know, one of the things, and you can go on, there's a lot, because this was a very, very public story. I mean, what happened to you writing the article for the Academic Journal got news coverage. What happened to the professor that you spent most of the book talking about and really getting into his Title IX case played out in the news as well. And there were protests. And you kind of mentioned in the book, which is really interesting to me, this idea of generational feminism, where a different generation, a generation before, was burning bras and saying, stay out of my life, government. Stay out of my sex. Stay out of my social life. And you're seeing on campus today students saying, come into my life. It's a very strange concept of almost contrast between generations of feminists.
Yeah, and I do want to make clear, I'm writing as a feminist. And, you know, a lot of these issues have been taken up by people on the right, and I will call myself a left-wing feminist. But, yeah, I think there is a real generational difference. You know, when I was coming of age, people were talking a lot about pleasure. They certainly were not inviting regulation from, you know, campus administrators. We're protesting that kind of paternalism. And the version of feminism that's reigning on campus is almost unrecognizable to me. And I think it's very conservative. I think it's paternalistic. And I know that sounds oxymoronic to talk about paternalist kind of feminism, but I think there's nothing emancipatory about it. And I do think that there's a way in which these different forces have collided, where the universities kind of favoring regulation and a certain kind of bureaucratic tendency on the part of this new generation of feminists, like wanting to use the power of the administration to, make more and more regulations. Yeah. I simply think it's not in women's interest.
You mentioned politics. It's fascinating because this issue, the idea of overregulation and the government stepping into social life, that this is something that, that is championed by the right. You see it as a big through line in the Trump administration, the Trump campaign. That and even in your case, the right came to your defense to say, yes, this is when you're even seeing with Betsy DeVos and Trump today talk about sort of, you know, we need to get rid of these regulations when it comes to sexual assault. We need to really sort of figure out what it is and get our hands as a federal government out of it. I mean, it sounds a lot like the same things you're saying. How does it feel to be a left-wing feminist being sort of championed by the right?
Well, you know, the politics of this is just incoherent to me, and I'm really still spending a lot of time trying to figure it out. So one of the things that happened was I became this kind of free speech poster child, and I had never thought of myself as, you know, free speech was always something I took for granted. So because the supposed activism on campus seems to be far less interested in stuff like free speech than, you know, has traditionally been the position of, like, you know, left liberals, it's the libertarians who seem to be most interested in issues about, like, speech and due process and that kind of thing. So you've got conservatives and libertarians acting like liberals, and you've got the student activists acting like authoritarians and, you know, inviting regulations in ways that we once associated with conservatives. So regulations in terms of behavior, regulating mm-hmm. behavior. I mean, I understand conservatives, you know, don't want to regulate the economy. So, you know, there's just all of these different tendencies that I find at this moment incoherent.
It is politically. Politically, when you think of college campuses, really at the epicenter of a lot of what when we talk about regulation, we talk about politics. The idea of safe spaces, you know, other things that are happening on college campuses that throw the ire of a far right or a right conservative citizen. That there is this sort of idea that regulation, especially the way it plays out and the way that kids are using it, is misguided and misplaced. And that seems to be very similar to what you're saying in the blog.
Yeah, I mean, I read a very interesting article online by James Livingston, and it was about liberalism versus liberty, I guess, I'm mangling this a bit, but it's this question of what's happened to liberalism in this focus on equity on campus. And so liberty is the thing that goes out the window. So, I mean, I guess it is the conservatives and libertarians who are still interested in this notion of individual liberty. And the tendency of the activists seems to be to focus on ensuring equality by any means, even if it means tossing out individual liberties. And so that's what I got caught up in, having written an essay that people didn't like, then trying to use the power of the university against me, a professor, a left-wing feminist, to punish me for having written an essay that goes against the grain of, you know, their particular kind of thinking.
And you talk about this as well in the book, but it's very hard to take sides on sexual assault. I mean, you're either. There's no doubt about it. I mean, that's why you see a lot of. You don't see a lot of debate around this topic.
No, and as I say throughout the book, I mean, I'm certainly in no way minimizing the seriousness of it as an issue.
And the idea that you stepping out and saying, "Hey, we really kind of rein this in. What is the definition of sexual assault? What we're seeing a lot of or overreaching by the government and administrators, and to have the kind of backlash that you had." Where there was this sort of shutdown. We don't talk about this issue. This is not something we're not going to talk about the things that are happening. How does that surprise you?
It surprises me a lot because, you know, again, I sound sort of like some, you know, it was so good in the old days, but, you know, like an old fogey. But I mean, my idea of what a university culture is about is talking about things and having hard discussions about controversies and issues. And this idea that speaking about things is itself somehow injurious is not what I think the university should be about. And I think part of the issue is there's almost like a dumbing down of university life because of these new sensitivities and this idea that we're not supposed to talk about controversies or risk saying something that might, you know, ruffle someone's feelings. Is, again, not what I think a university should be dedicating itself to.
Laura, you kind of say this throughout the book. Are you worried about losing your job?
I feel really lucky to be employed at Northwestern. And, you know, despite having gone through this Title IX case, I don't think the university had much of a choice with that. And, I mean, there were people that got angry at me for saying that. I got called somebody accused me of, like, Stockholm syndrome. And it's not that I was defending the university, but I understand that they are caught in between all of these different forces, between the federal government and the risk of losing federal funding if they aren't seen to be, keeping an eye on Title IX and the student activist population and certain faculty who would support that. But I think Northwestern is a great place. I've been employed there for many more decades than I would like to say. And I am a loyalist, you know, and would like it to keep on, you know, being a place where people can, as I have, write against the grain and have academic freedom. And, you know, I think the university supports academic freedom.
Even as we speak, I mean, there are lawsuits that are mounting. There's protests. It's one thing to write about it. Then you double down with another article and then triple down with a book. I mean, there is this idea that, I mean, as the more and more you speak about it, the more and more it is causing a conversation, whether you like it or not. But, I mean, you probably like it. How does that feel to know that around every corner there seems to be another sort of controversy waiting?
Well, as you mentioned, there have been attempts to silence me. I don't want to sound paranoid, but there is a lawsuit. I can't talk about it, obviously. But, you know, I think there are people who are trying to use these regulatory kinds of mechanisms, or whether it's Title IX or lawsuits, to silence someone whose views that they don't like. And the thing is, it's had the opposite effect on me. It made me feel like I actually had to stand up to this. And I, you know, I'm not an activist. I'm this kind of ironic cultural critic. I'd never thought I would be in this position, but I found that I didn't want to be silenced.
Well, it's a fascinating book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. The author, Laura Kipnis, is a film professor at Northwestern. Thanks so much for coming in, and thank you for being my guest.
Thanks for the great conversation.
Coming up tomorrow in the 9 o'clock hour, Adasha Townsend's going to be here. We're going to talk about patios. The summer patios are opening up after Memorial Day. We'll get some rooftop news. That's what we should call it. Rooftop news. Also, you know who's coming back? I'm really excited about this. Our awesome tour guide, Margaret Hicks. Chicago Elevated.
What she got going on?
She's got the summer tours, walking tours from downtown, all the different areas. So we'll have her as well. And tomorrow, Never Have I Ever as well. So that's coming up, or that's the 9 o'clock. Never I Ever being the 10. Great. It's great to talk with Laura Kipnis. That, you know, it's so interesting to me because Rob mentioned last week that she was being sued. There was a lawsuit pending from someone mentioned in the book. And then I read the book and I was like, I think I know who it is, right? But because of the lawsuit, she's essentially on gag order. So the big part of that book, and the part that I'm fascinated, she really goes into it's almost like an episode of Serial, you know, or one of the mystery podcasts. She goes into the Title IX file of this philosophy professor and really kind of re-prosecutes it. And she retries it in a way. She like goes through all the notes of the prosecutor. She goes through all this, and she makes a strong argument. Now it's not an actual justice argument, but it's in her book the argument that the findings were wrong, that he should not have been dismissed, and he should not have been, you know, dragged through the mud for dating a student, or having relationships with a student. So anyway. That's a big part. And I mean, she's going to go on tour and talk about that part of the book. I mean, there's characters. It's a mystery. It's who, what, you know, it's a whodunit, a beginning, middle, end story. It's the crux, three quarters of the book. But because one of the grad students in this story has filed essentially a defamation lawsuit. She's not allowed to talk about it. So you can read the book, and that's fine, it's out. But she's not allowed to talk about the story or the characters or any of that stuff on her press tour. That's interesting. And because at a certain point, that's what she wrote about. That's what, you know, she would be able to eloquently tell that story and have it be part of the media landscape, and she can't. I mean, it was essentially the lawsuit is a gag order. Wow. And it is a story that's beyond just that one case, but it really does. It's interesting because there was a lot, and I went through it. I was doing some research on it, that even during the campaign, Donald Trump spent time talking about this issue, not specifically this case, but, mm-hmm. but talked about the overreach of the federal government in Title IX. He talked about, and I want to paraphrase, but I'm sure it was, it's so unfair. It wasn't a very eloquent speech towards the issue, but the point being that he believed the federal government shouldn't be involved in that and we need to pull back on that. So there is something of what Laura is talking about is very similar to what Donald Trump talked about in the campaign.
There was a great saying that I heard in the course of this debate, and I can't remember who I need to attribute it to. But it basically went something like, regrettable sex isn't necessarily sexual assault.
Yeah.
And that's what most college students find themselves in when you have, you know, very casual dalliances. And, you know, the next morning you don't feel right.
She makes an argument in the book that the confusion and messiness, I think she used the word messiness or sloppiness around college sex, is part of understanding what sex is. And she makes it very clear, and I want to make this very clear to everybody because I don't want to take it out of context, but she makes it very clear that she draws a strong, hard line between what is consensual sex and sexual assault and rape. She's not going into rape, the discussion about rape culture or sexual assault and saying, well, you know, she's not doing that. She's talking about, you know, that sex being taught right now in our generation and this generation and the culture is the idea that sex is bad, sex is trauma, sex is going to kill you. She has that in the book, a whole chapter about that's what the new generation is learning. That's different than a generation before. But it is, to me, it's really fascinating, this concept of, you know, that the kids and how you make choices, sexual choices, when you're 20 years old, 19 years old, give you a better understanding of how you're going to, you know, approach sex in the future. And I think that that's what she was saying. Why would you want the government to get involved in that at early ages? There's something to that. Let's take a break. And we come back, I missed this. I mean, I heard it and I wanted to say something when we were caught up in the interview, but the Indianapolis 500 is coming up. That's a Rob Martyr joint. Right?
That's how I roll.
That's how you roll. You going down? Are you going down?
I will be down there on Sunday. We go down Saturday.
Man. All right.
Be all geeked out.
All right. I got questions.
Hopefully I have answers.
All right, good. Hold on. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN, Chicago, WGNradio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Greg Flam coming up with Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We'll evaluate your junk. Rob Martyr, the Indianapolis 500 is on my Never Have I Ever. I've never gone down there, and I remember I regret it because there were some friends of mine in college that were like, we're going down the Indianapolis 500 this weekend. I was like, yeah, well, and then I just blew it off.
This will be my dad's 47th Indianapolis 500.
Wow.
He's only missed one since his college days at Northwestern. I've been to probably about eight now, and it is quite the spectacle. It's a lot of fun.
Is it like NASCAR where you sit in the middle with the motorhomes and stuff like that, or is it different?
There is an element of that at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We actually sit on the outside of the track. We're actually at the end of the front straight, so we get to see them coming out of four and then going into turns one and two.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Are you going to write a tell-all, like a book? about your experiences
at the... You know, I'm all geeked out. I've got my headsets on. I get to listen into the drivers. I get to listen into the TV broadcast. Let's see. Scott Dixon is on the pole. He had a four-lap average of 232.164 miles per hour.
Is this the dude who got robbed in Taco Bell?
This is the dude that got robbed at the Taco Bell. Yeah, he got robbed at the Taco Bell. So now, he's now more known for that. Getting robbed at the Taco Bell along with another driver, and I think his wife was on board as well.
Oh,
but but that's basically going around 2.5 miles at about 39 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, that's moving.
Oh, man.
So it'll be
fun.
All
right, well, we'll have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely.
When we get back here on Tuesday. All right.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books. Or silverware, as long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
That's me.
Hey, all right, it's a Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Very excited tonight to bring you another installment of one of my favorite segments, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, see if it's worth anything, and tell us what you want to brag about. This is a perfect opportunity for you to brag about the dumb stuff you've collected over the years.
Perfect opportunity.
I feel like that's all I ever want.
Right.
Is people to tell me what goofy thing they have hanging in their foyer so I can go, you're the best.
Right. And sometimes just getting that moment to brag about it, you know, like 50,000 watt station, why not?
Yeah, why not, right?
You might only get that one time.
312-981-7200. Because let's face it, that's why you got it in the first place.
Right.
You got the piece of memorabilia because you're like, I want to tell people about this.
Yep.
And then nobody comes over and you're like, no. And you're like, I know. I'll call the swap meet. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Twitter and Facebook. Good to see you, Greg. How are you?
Good to see you, Justin. Awesome.
Did you have a good weekend? Was it a good weekend?
It was good. It was, again, another more selling than picking weekend, but I did find a couple things and brought them into the show.
All right. What do you got here?
Okay. I normally don't do the repurposed thing so much, but I couldn't pass on. This is a printer's tray where they keep the stamps back in the day. And people are repurposing these shadow boxes. And so on. And obviously, I've noticed lately that the shadow box thing has kind of gotten more hot on eBay and reselling. So for $5,
me,
I couldn't.
Yeah, you don't strike me as a shadow box.
No, I'm not. And, you know, I mean, I was, anyway, yeah, I digress. But the shadow box thing, yeah, usually the more spaces, the more money. So this has, I think, 90 spaces or something.
All right.
So it's crazy. So they're worth, like, this one, they're like $30 to $90. And you can see, like, they had the, you know, they painted over the Hamilton handle, which devalues it, but they left this part. So it's kind of cool, the name of the font. So, yeah, I brought that. And more thrilling, what I normally buy are records, but I found these.
Ooh.
Color disc, so I'm drawn to that, picture disc or colored vinyl, and I happen to pick these up, and they're from 1957. They are Buick Motor Division, General Motors, and these were used with the slide projector to teach the sales team at Buick, not people at home buying the cars, but this was like a sales tag. And what's
so
great
you
is like
sell cars with
right,
Buick, right?
And here's where your 1940s accent will come in.
Hello,
right? And so one side has the chime to turn the slide, and the other side doesn't.
Oh,
so,
that's great.
And there's two of them, and they're red and blue, and they're kind of cool.
You say, know, you want to be my Buick salesman.
Right.
Right.
Right, so it's stuff like that. I like the ones called Confidence Man. So that's, you know.
Say, you're looking for confidence.
Right.
Bing.
And the other,
turn
right.
Turn the page.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
This one's called The Story of Prospector Pete.
So it's sort of like,
yeah. And
he went out and found gold.
That's right.
What have you done?
Right.
Sell a car.
Sell a car, right. So they're cool. They should be worth about $100.
I like that. That's great. 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text. We're going to have some fun tonight. Let's start with Terry. Terry, what do you want to brag about, Terry?
Well, it's my friend. I've seen it and I'm in awe of this every time I go over there. Agnes Moore has the address book, it's written in her handwriting. She always used a purple pen or a purple flare.
Agnes Moore. Agnes Moore's from Bewitched. Is that what Agnes Moore? Moorhead, right?
Right. Andora.
Andora, right.
And she had a career in the stage before that. In fact, let me just say real quick, her family were missionaries. When she passed away, they resided up in Wisconsin, like around Baraboo, Wisconsin. So when that estate was cleared out, these were gotten on the back of the truck, of a pickup truck at the end of the day. And I think everything was gotten for $15.
Wow.
So, yeah. So
what's,
I mean,
in the personal address book?
Well, I said Charisse. Lucille Ball.
Wow.
Well, Dick Sargent, Dick York, you know, Elizabeth, yeah, Montgomery, but a lot of Richard Widmark and overseas.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just everybody. Cary Grant. Wow. I mean, and overseas, I'm losing it right now, but who's the one that did My Fair Lady? Really pretty woman.
I know this. Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Audrey Hepburn.
Boom.
And her
Look
song.
At that. Did, oh, wow, I just nail a fact from the 50s?
Woo!
Wow.
Did you ever try to crank call and see if these people are around anymore?
Well, actually, a lot of it, Carol Channing still is, and Richard Widmark was still alive, and I kind of wanted to do it, but I tell you, when you look through it, it's kind of like, if you've ever been to Elvis Presley's place.
Yeah. I haven't been, but yeah.
You feel like you don't belong there, like you're intruding.
Wow.
And that's how I felt when I walked through Graceland. And so I'm looking through this book, too, and I'm just seeing things that I'm not supposed to see. But I love all this stuff. Wow. I love Hollywood.
Definitely neat. It's got a great story. Obviously, it's something I'm not going to be able to find a, you know, comparable price to tell you what it's worth. Yeah. I mean, but just looking at Agnes Moorehead, books alone are going for like $78. And I don't even think they're signed. You know, they're just her. That's how rare her books are, I guess.
Yeah, there's turn-of-the-century children's books that were hers,
okay,
and then playbills and all that other kind of stuff. But it's really the nostalgia of the 70s.
Terry,
60s, 70s.
Some of the texters are texting in saying, I shouldn't let this bit get away, that you should give us the personal book so we can crank call these people. But
oh,
I'm not going to do
no.
that.
Right?
No, you won't do
no,
it.
No, 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 no. Yeah. No, it's not going to happen. But anyway, thank you,
I appreciate
you guys.
It. Thanks, Terry.
Show,
thank you, Terry.
Love
thanks
you.
For
thank you for calling.
All right, that's interesting. And then also 630 says, I have her makeup case with her initials AM, Agnes Moorehead.
Okay.
Went to an auction sale decades ago. So she's giving everything away.
Yes, somehow her there stuff's getting out.
312-981-7200. What do you want to brag about? What do you want to find out? Your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk, if it's worth anything. Greg Flamm at DuPage Pickers here. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. David wrote Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Come on, Greg. You don't know your young adult, your YA literature?
Nope.
They made a movie out of it.
Wow.
Starring Michael Cera.
Okay.
It was nonplussed. That's the Greg Flamm
That's
way.
Right.
We're playing Swap Meet tonight. 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Got some good stuff. Let's go right to the phones. Let's go to Andrew. Andrew, what do you want to brag about, bud?
Yeah, good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Well, not me. I was visiting my aunt in France last year, and she showed me a handwritten letter by Albert Schweitzer.
Mm. Wow.
Remind me again, who's Albert Schweitzer?
Oh, he was that French theologian from a long time ago, a philosopher,
right,
physician, medical missionary, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah,
what do you got, Greg?
We're finding...
I don't know what it says because I don't know read French. So.
That would help, yeah. We're seeing three different letters here, ranging from $375 to $1,000. There was one from 1945. It was just a signed letter. I don't think it was handwritten. That went for $1,000, but they had certificate of authenticity and all that.
Was this handwritten?
Yes, sir. It was.
Yeah.
So it could be more.
All right.
About a full page. Yeah, full
okay.
Page. Mm-hmm. Sign, et cetera, et cetera.
So. Maybe you can get that translated and see what
I'll
that
bet
was about.
I'll bet you it says, we think therefore we are. Could you please pass the red wine and cheese? That's my guess.
Good.
That's
sounds good.
All right,
we'll
thanks,
go with
Andrew.
That.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, sir.
312-981-7200. It was a page long, so it was. Please pass the red wine and cheese. And then it said, do you want a croissant? And then it said, let's just kiss in only the way that the French can.
Nice.
That's, I think, what that's what. That I'm not sure. I'm not. Right. I don't speak the language, but I'm guessing.
Right.
A philosopher would say that. 630 says it's likely in German, not French, because Schweitzer was German.
Hmm. Okay.
All right. A lot of bits tonight. The texts are filled with bits from right. our regulars.
Okay.
Who are having a lot of fun. 630 says he's a winning bidder on this 19th century snuff bottle.
What?
Which is, you know, it looks like it's, you could see, take a look. It's okay. Like a, you can see the picture here. Come on by. It's cool. It's got, it's art, artistry, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's kind of a cool, I don't know how you find out what that's worth, but it's a cool look.
Yep. Yeah. Checking that out now.
All right. 312-981-7200. You know, I wonder, when you talk about handwritten letters, and we had this a couple of weeks ago, and it was funny because I think we were just talking with Rob Elder about his Ernest Hemingway project. And it was funny because he was doing all this Hemingway research to find Ernest Hemingway letters, memorabilia, whatever, because it's all part of the Hemingway house. But it's, he's sort of almost like a mystery to find out more about him. Okay. And he had found letters that were in a trunk of somebody he had tracked down. And, you know, we were talking about how amazing it was. And then just think about it in the terms of swap meet. That's probably worth a ton of money. Like to have a letter, like right. a love letter from Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. I got excited when I found like a letter in a 1950s yearbook when I found that. So I can only imagine what like Ernest Hemingway letter. That's got to be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder like when you are... online and you're thinking about these letters and things that come through, there's a lot of that stuff, I would assume. A lot of dignitaries, historians, philosophers, theologians, as we just mentioned with Schweitzer, there's a lot of opportunity to get collectibles off of people writing letters and communicating like they did in their time.
Yeah, especially in books, people stuff, you know, items in there. So you never know how long that stays in there. So. Right.
All right, 312-981-7200. All right, let's... 630 says, Schweitzer is famous for saying, example is not the main thing in influencing, it's the only thing.
Hmm.
We're getting real philosophical yeah. here. All right, what are you going to say?
No, the snuff bottles, some of them have gone for $85,000.
No way.
Yeah, they range from...
$85,000?
Yeah, one sold... I don't have the date here, but there's a lot, 25,000, 16,000, 15,000. So what was the date on the one that the caller?
It says 19th touched? Century.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't know. That's the details on it are amazing. But.
Yeah, it's one of those things where they're 65 or 85,000. So definitely have that checked out.
All right. All right, let's go to 312-981-7200. Here's what we'll do. Let's take one call, and then we'll break for the news. Let's go to Annie. Annie, what do you got, Annie? What do you want to brag about?
Oh, I don't have anything to brag about. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. What do you got?
I got to listen to you guys more often. Do you do this every week?
We do every Wednesday night. And just, I mean, when I say what do you want to brag about, it's just what you're calling to evaluate.
Well, it was that. And then I have two rehearsal tapes of Seinfeld with the NBC envelope.
Okay.
And I was wondering what the value is. I have no one to ask about these things.
What was the first one? What did you? Pete's got it written up here. First Dungeons and Dragons book. What is that?
Gary Gygax is the creator of Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
That was the first one. It was autographed to me, and he used to live in Lake Geneva.
Oh wow!
And I was a resident there, and that's how I came about that. I used to wait on them every day.
Wow. See, that's a great story.
That is. There's your brag.
What do you mean you don't want to brag about that? That's an awesome brag.
Okay. Do you own this? Do you still have this?
Yes.
I don't think you understand how much money that is worth, because Dungeons & Dragons is huge. And anytime I could pick up anything Dungeons, I'm not a player myself with that, but anytime I could pick that up, it's a fast sell and it's usually decent money. So you might want to. If you do sell, make sure you do an auction, because that is really rare, and I don't think you understand.
Well, Dungeons and Dragons.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I want to sell it. I do want to sell it.
Yeah. If you want to write me through my Facebook page, DuPage Picker, I'd be happy to help you with that. It will be a fast sell, no doubt.
All right, we'll do that. Thank you for allowing me and giving more attention to the show next time.
No problem. Thank you for calling, Ann.
Thanks, Annie. Thank you. All right, there you go. She's and, like, I don't know what this is, but I just got bank.
Yeah, and her Seinfeld, you know, some of that has been $400, $800 too. So she's got some good stuff.
See,
that,
this is a underestimating about this thing. Yes, we have some fun, joke around, but there are times that people can get hit pay dirt.
Right, they don't.
The idea
know.
That you have a couple of Seinfeld pages laying around, you're going to get $400. You're like, I needed $400.
Right.
The Dungeons and Dragons book. I needed
that's huge.
That cash.
I can't tell you how huge that is.
There you go.
So that was a good one.
Right now she's fretting. She's like, why did I rip out 16 pages of that thing and use it as a napkin?
Right.
312-981-7200. We're doing the swap meet with Greg Flamm. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the second half. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flamm.
Here we are.
There we go. 312-981-7200, the phone number to call in to evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. Greg's got you at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We got a lot to get to. Let's get to it. Let's go to Mary. Mary, what do you want to brag about, Mary?
Hi. We have a letter that my mother received from the former Chancellor of Germany, Willy Brandt.
Wow.
Brandt. Yeah, well, my mother dated him way back when.
Wow.
What? I thought this was going to be like a formal, like, welcome to the country or don't ever come back to this country. This was a love letter?
No, they lost touch, and he just reconnected with her. Of course, it's in German, you know, and that. Would that be of any value with that? Or
there's
not?
So much more I want to know about.
Right.
When you're getting love letters from a German chancellor.
Was it a love letter. It was very formal.
Oh, it was? Well, maybe that's just how the Germans did it back then. You know, maybe
I don't know.
Wasn't like...
This was just a couple years before he died and that, you know.
So what year would this be?
In the 50s or 60s.
Wow.
Yeah, I found one that recently sold for $35. It was just a signed...
Was it a love letter?
It wasn't a letter. It was just kind of a signed piece of paper.
No, it was very formal, you know.
Yeah,
so. But this is
personal. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
like,
it was personal, yeah. Because they dated way back when, before she married my father and that, you know.
Did she always rub that into your father's face? Like, hey, I dated a chancellor.
Not necessarily. I don't remember, no.
Right.
You know, and you know, and that, and we met him once, you know, when we were over there, and you know, and that. So, you know, but the letter wouldn't be that valuable, huh?
It could be $100 to $300. What I'm thinking, if just his signature on a piece of paper type thing was $35. I mean, you have a letter written out, so
it's a 3-page letter,
yeah,
and very formal, you know, addressed to my mother and that, you know,
and it's written out. It's handwritten.
It's handwritten.
Yeah, and if you do sell it, just make sure you do an auction. Don't do a fixed price because you never know.
Did he start it with, hi, what's up? How you been? How's your summer? No?
No, he was very formal. Like, you know, it's been a while since we communicated in that and, you know, and how my mother got back with him, I don't remember. You know, and that, you know, but it was just very like she was very glad just to receive it and that he's doing well. He married somebody else, of course, you know, and, you know, and that, you know.
Well, you got a great story anyway.
It just sounds like the OG Facebook message.
Justin, can I ask you a question for that?
Uh-huh.
You know that you sound in a way like Pete McMurray. Did anybody ever tell you that?
No one's ever said that to me, but I will take that. That's high praise, as they say in the business.
Yeah, no, in the beginning, you sounded, you know, when Pete
did you just think
Murray,
Pete was still on the air?
Yeah, well, he subs sometimes for Steve Cochran and that, you know.
Yep.
But no, okay, well, no, I just
all right, cool.
You know, well,
next time I see Pete, I'll let him know that. See what he says.
I appreciate that. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks
Mary. For calling.
Have a good evening and a good holiday.
Thank you. What a find.
Yep.
to say that you have a love letter from the German chancellor, and the chancellor's all formal when he had, I mean,
three pages.
You're getting to the end of your life and you want to reach out to an old flame. You know what? You got to break through a little bit. You got to make that a little cash.
You got to work a little bit, yeah.
Getting too formal. All right, there's a lot of stuff here.
Yep.
Let's try this one on for size. 708 says, I have the Dungeons & Dragons Dungeon Master Guide. First edition, I believe. Very good condition.
Mm-hmm.
What's it worth?
Like we discussed, Dungeons & Dragons always comes through. And I found one, a first edition of the second printing when as high as $3,800. So
come on,
yeah.
Are these people just throwing money around.
I guess
a second edition, $3,800.
Yeah, and some have gone as low as $80, but the one that was first edition, second printing, $3,800. But I've had no problem selling anything Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. Somebody else just texted as well. I thought you were Pete McMurray when the first time, a couple times I heard you too. Wow,
there you go.
Hey, I'll take it.
Take it.
All right. Some more stuff here. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Millie. Millie, what do you want to brag about, Millie?
Well, I have this German walking stick that my father brought back from World War II when he served in Germany.
Wow. Okay.
And on it, it has carved all the things the Germans used during the war. And the bottom of it is actually supposed to represent the bayonet. It's a sharp tip.
Wow.
Yeah, it has tanks and pillboxes and airplanes and helmets and all kinds of things.
Wow.
It is interesting. So there's carvings on it. Do they seem individually carved, or is that just how the walking stick came? It seems like it's mass produced.
More so that when he came home from the war, he was a drinker. So my grandmother took it away from him until he stopped drinking.
Wow.
He was sober 2 years. She finally gave it back to him.
Yeah, some are just German walking sticks in general are in the 400 range. Mm-hmm. That one I'd have to think be more if they actually, you know, was in the war. They carved what they were using, kind of what they call trench art. Where you know, they would do that with the casings for, you know, shells and stuff like that. They would just make stuff from it, and that, you know, that goes for pretty good money.
Mm-hmm. Where could I take something like that?
Probably an antique dealer could probably appraise that for you. If you want to send a picture to the Facebook page, I could try to help you a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. That's a good one. I like that a lot. Yeah, I don't know what to do with it, but it's something cool to brag about.
Yep.
Right?
I know, and you know, my boys are going to fight over it after I'm gone, so I figure I'd get rid of it before that.
There you go.
Okay. Well,
all right.
Thanks,
Millie.
Taking my call.
Thank you.
Thanks
for listening.
Thank
you very much.
Nice.
That's the
casino trip.
We need to pull that out. That's the clip of the swap meet.
Right.
Well, my boys are going to fight over it when I'm gone, so I might as well get rid of it now.
Get rid of it.
Let's go to Dolores. Dolores, what do you want to brag about, Dolores?
Yes, I have a book that I bought back in the 50s. It's an original first edition, Old Man and the Sea.
Yeah.
But it has the original dust jacket cover on it with a sticker price from Webolt's a store for $2.95.
Wow.
I know Webolt's. Everybody in Chicago knows Webolt's.
Everybody from Chicago knows Webolt's.
There was still a Webolt's in... The old Webolt's, wasn't there a Webolt's at Ashland and...
Ashland and Belmont, and Lincoln.
Right. It became the Whole Foods, right?
The Whole Foods. Well, not now. It's
Right. What are they going to do with that? I just thought about this. I drove by there and I saw they cleared that Whole Foods out and they created the Whole Foods. They made a new one across the street. That's the old Webolt's building. What did they do with that building? Tear it down?
They didn't ask me to take it.
I went to the one in Yorktown, I think, is the one I went to.
Yeah, there you go. Dolores, would you like this Webolt's? All right, so a first edition of Old Man and the Sea.
Okay.
Books, you don't do well with books.
I don't, but I was able to find this one. It's kind of common, but it has gone for upwards of $800. There are quite a few of them. I'll describe the cover, so maybe she can. Is she still on the line?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still
it's
here.
Kind of most of the book is sky, and then below it.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, then that's the one. You're in the probably $400 to $800 range if it's in great condition.
Wow, no, there you go.
It's in good condition. I never let the kids get at it. You know, they would love to add their comments and write with sure. Crayolas and stuff. I had it up high most of my life.
There you go.
I'm glad that there's no crayons.
Until they got big enough to read it, then they could use it, you know. There you go. But I just wondered because I've never done anything about it.
Yeah. Well, you got something good, that's for sure.
Thanks, Dolores.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Well, 312-981-7200. We will take a break. We'll come back and we'll get a couple more calls in. We've got some texts as well. We're doing a swap meet tonight. Greg Flam's here. Stay with us. Swap meet, 312-981-7200. Let's get to all the calls and texts before we wrap up here in about 5 minutes. Catherine, what do you want to brag about tonight?
Hi, actually, I have two things. And I was saying to the gentleman that answered the phone, it appears German night tonight. But
I love it.
My dad had a friend that was a prisoner of war. He was captured and put in a concentration camp. And the story has it that when he was on his way out, he actually grabbed a paperweight off an officer's desk. So I have a Nazi paperweight.
Wow.
And I also have a rug. It's like a hand done loomed rug with, it's probably 2x3, but it has the Nazi symbols all around the edge. Wow. Not like I put these items out, but I just, you know, they've got such a history to them that I was thinking either sell them or donate them to the Holocaust Museum or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's amazing. And,
I mean, the story, it was just a crazy story, you know, it's like.
And, you know, it's funny too, Catherine, because on the swap meet, we'll get sometimes where people will call in or text in with Nazi paraphernalia or memorabilia.
Right.
And that stuff has a whole subgenre of collection, for good reasons, but
right.
For
I mean,
history,
it's history bad part, but is there any kind of value you could,
there sure is. I can't find paperweights, even rugs. I really couldn't find, but it's definitely got a value, and I would have it checked out for sure. And then you could decide if you want to
donate. Would you even take something like this?
You know, if you just Google like World War II memorabilia expert, you'll probably get a few in this area. They line up every week for certain estate sales that have World War II items, so you won't have time
to
find
them. Yeah, and they're in perfect
George kind of on 331 just wrote it in, too. That's the same question I was thinking in my head. I mean, you have to also watch out because Nazi memorabilia is in that weird world of is it legal or illegal. I mean, some stuff, I don't think this falls into that category because it's a paperweight on
right.
that. But there's some stuff that is just, you know,
no,
considered
right.
hate and you're not supposed to.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
So watch what you Google.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
not at work.
Dark web I should go into. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Catherine.
Awesome. Appreciate thanks for calling.
It. Thank you so much. Good night.
All right. Let's keep going. Let's go to Eric. Eric, what do you want to brag about, Eric?
Hey, guys. I live out in the burbs, way out in a small town near Rockford. I have a 100-year-old house. And I was rehabbing it several years ago, and I pulled out of the walls a bunch of old paperwork and stuff that has, like, ties to Chicago, which I thought was kind of odd being out near Rockford. But, like, one of them that's really neat is I think it was put out in a, like, a Sunday circular announcement in a newspaper of a Easter service, and it's a full-color picture like you would it's like a picture of like Jesus and whatnot like you would see in a stained glass, and it's from like some Presbyterian church in downtown Chicago, and the date on it I believe is 1901.
And
the colors are still really vibrant. There's a little bit of damage. It looked like it had been rolled up and then folded in half and then stuffed in my rafters, and so I over the course of several months, I would open it up a little bit at a time until I got it completely flat. And now it's just sitting behind a door because I don't want it to deteriorate anymore. But, you know, something like that. And then I've also got a neat little pamphlet that I think was put out by, I don't know, maybe somebody out in Seattle or something. It was like how to get rich in the gold fields.
Ah.
And it was like, is this pamphlet had a map in it. and it had all kinds of like checklists and things, that shopping lists like you needed to buy from the outfitters out there to get past Seattle.
That's very specific stuff, man.
Yeah, I joke with my brother. The only people who got rich from the gold rush were the people selling the supplies, you know, the picks and stuff like that, you know. So that's interesting.
Exactly.
And,
And I mean, just a bunch of other different kind of weird stuff like that. I've got an old perennial magazine advertising all kinds of flowers and stuff from a from a florist in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, that's
and
neat.
Weird,
it's cool stuff.
Yeah, so... Is there any idea on where I could take this stuff to get it appraised, or is there any value to it other than just kind of curiosity stuff?
It's a good question. You know,
I don't know what kind of value there is. Yeah. To be honest with you, I mean, maybe there is in the sense, I mean, because it's commercial literature, but you might, if you're just curious about it, the Historical Society might be a spot.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure there's someone will buy that if you put it online, for sure. As far as giving you a value, I couldn't tell you. I could just say maybe, you know, throw it online and see, you know, do a long auction, like a 10-day auction, and see, give it enough time to sit there and see who might be interested in it. But I'm sure it will sell.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to wrap up the swap meet. Got a lot of texts in saying, hey, the woman with the paperweight rug should seek out experts at the university, maybe the Holocaust Museum in Skokie, but the idea of profiting off of that might be a difficult idea.
Yep.
All right, so thank you so much for bringing us your ideas. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Greg, always a pleasure
always
to see
fun.
You.
Never
great
know.
Show tonight.
Thank you.
That's going to do it tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Tomorrow night, we're going to play Never Have I Ever. 312-981-7200. Always fun. Never have I ever gone to the Indianapolis 500.
You need to.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. All right, coming up, Patty.